Welcome to Healthcare is Hard, a podcast for insiders. Each episode, LRB Health's Keith Viglioli will talk to the healthcare insiders who are helping to fundamentally transform our healthcare industry.
Hey everyone, this is Tom Salemi. Welcome back to Healthcare is Hard, a podcast for insiders. It's August and I'm here with our host, Keith Viglioli. Keith, how has the summer been for you?
The summer is good, but as we were just joking, I think we're both battling allergies today. So if we start hacking it up a little bit in this intro, I apologize to people.
Yeah, they call it a cough button for a reason, but we never sleep and neither does innovation. You had a great conversation with Tal Heppenstall, the president of UPMC Enterprises. And I think a large part of this conversation was that healthcare providers and integrated companies like UPMC need to keep pushing forward on the innovation.
Yeah, I think this is one I've been wanting to do for a while, and we've been going back and forth with Tal to try to get him on. One, because of the uniqueness of UPMC, which people will dig into more and some people already know, but this idea of a truly integrated healthcare delivery arm and a truly large healthcare payer in Western Pennsylvania, is unique. You know, there's a handful of them around the country like Kaiser, UPMC, Intermountain, a few others that have these large sort of payer integrated arms. The other thing that's unique here is Tal's role, where, as people hear, Tal came from sort of the investing banking land and then moved over and always was in healthcare and moved over into the health system side because he covered UPMC for a long period of time. But he's got this pretty cool role where he's the treasurer of the system, where he handles billions upon billions of dollars in terms of how to make sure cash is invested wisely. And then secondly, is the head, to your point, and the president of UPMC Enterprises, which in essence is their innovation arm, is their arm that they do allocate capital. And he has this whole call out as part of the interview, which I thought was fascinating because I always thought of UPMC Enterprises as a little bit of their fund. But he was very clear in saying it's not a fund, Keith. It's just where we allocate capital to do innovation, which I think is a really important delineation because there's been so much debate, and we've talked about it on the podcast, I think the last couple of months, of a lot of people bantering around this idea of why does a health system or why does an integrated payer and health system have venture platforms? And I think Tal is like, stop calling it that. That's not what we're doing. We're fully innovating day in, day out at the health system and the payer. And this is an allocation of capital that frees it up to be able to do some very innovative things on the cutting edge. And I think it's the right way to think about it.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think everyone thinks about investment and looking to make millions and it's all about the money when it's really trying to improve the process. And you brought up prior to our pushing record, Mayo last week came out and essentially said the same thing, that this is not the time to stop innovating.
Yeah, and I think it's a big fallacy for people to just label these things as, oh, it's a health system fund, or, oh, it's UPMC Enterprises trying to be a venture capital platform or private equity platform. That's not what they're trying to do.
Right.
They're trying to constantly, and Tal brings this up, I think, two or three times in the interview, they're constantly trying to reinvent themselves. And it's such an important place right now for them to be thinking about that. But also, and we've brought this up in the past, they're an academic medical center. What's at the heart of academia? It's research, it's innovation, it's constantly thinking about what's next. And the thing that I don't think I appreciated before the interview, but I definitely appreciated about halfway through, was just the cultural difference and the cultural tone at UPMC that Tal was talking about, which is just different there. You know, they feel like if they're not taking risks, they're not doing their job. And sometimes you don't hear that, especially from the health system side of the equation. So I thought that was pretty refreshing to hear that directly from him and really the cultural tenet of that organization going all the way back before it was even a health system. So it was a pretty cool interview.
All right. Well, it was a great conversation and Tal's got a cool and easy manner. I would like to have him flying any commercial airliner that I'm on because it's just very reassuring and calm. So
he's definitely got a cooler interface than me. That's for dang sure.
Well, let's get into this conversation with Tal Heppenstall, the president of UPMC Enterprises.
Terrific. Well, we are back on the Healthcare is Hard podcast. I have to say, this is one I've been trying to do for a while with a dear friend, Tal Heppenstall from UPMC. I could not be more excited to do this with you today.
I don't know. Well, I should temper your enthusiasm until we're done.
Our banter in person has to be put in forth into the Zoom window, which I'm glad. At first, I was a little worried because you had just the phone action. I had to see your face as we were talking back and forth here.
You want it? You got it.
Well, Tal, to give everybody a point of view, I think most people know you, but Executive Vice President and Treasurer of UPMC and President of UPMC Enterprises, which we'll get into a little bit about what that means, because I do think you have a very unique role of the various healthcare system executives that I've talked to over the years in terms of what you do at UPMC and more importantly, what UPMC is, because it is a very unique place. But before we get going, like I always say, I'd love to start with just a little bit of background on yourself. You've been doing this a long time.
Yes, you're right. It's tragic.
So, but I'd love to understand how you even got here. Like, you know, was this like the vision back in college? Was this the, you know, you thought you were going to be in healthcare or you kind of meandered in?
I knew I was going to like, you know, become a better golfer and play professional golf, but that didn't work out. So I got here. I undergrad at the University of Virginia. Most of my education occurred outside of the classroom. So I got a job as a waiter in Pittsburgh in 1983 because I was as good as I could do. I was actually a busboy. Went to business school at Carnegie Mellon, decided studying was a good idea. Got a summer internship at a regional investment bank in Philadelphia because my wife told the placement director to convince the investment bank to hire me. I showed them how to use Lotus 1-2-3. That made me into a real live investment banker. So for a couple of years, I just did numbers, and then I went around and looked for clients. I stayed at a firm was called Butcher and Singer till 1989. I got hired by PNC Bank to cover what was to become UPMC in 1989. So I started as UPMC's investment banker in 1989, did that through 2003 when the then treasurer left, and they said to me that, gee whiz, we'd like you to be the treasurer of UPMC. I was currently at RBC as an investment banker at the time. I actually did a startup in the municipal bond business at the time. So the last thing I wanted was three jobs, but my startup wasn't going very well. So I decided that if I didn't take this job, I would lose about 60% of my client base because UPMC would get a new treasurer and they'd pick a new banker. So I pretty much had to take the job. So took it in 2003 and haven't regretted it for 1 minute.
Yeah. So it sounds very planned out. Sounds like you had it very kind of the way.
Exactly. So yeah, it's a lot of, and the old treasurer used to play a lot of golf. So I used to play a lot of golf with my client, yeah, the treasurer of UPMC. And as soon as I got here, like, they made it clear that playing golf a lot was not a treasurer's function. So my handicap has gone up a lot.
I mean, that gives you, and again, why I really wanted to do this is, you know, UPMC is thought of as such a thought leader and such an industry stalwart in terms of an anchored system in our country. You've been there for a long time. So give us a little bit. And some people might not even know all that you even have a payer, right? I mean, most people do, but some people might not even understand the full footprint of what UPMC is and isn't. So it'd be good maybe also to start with sort of your view of what it is and then flip that into sort of the evolution of how you got to this idea of UPMC Enterprises as well.
Yeah. So I'll give you the sort of, you know, the short answer to what UPMC is it's three different things. It's an academic medical center. It is the leading clinical provider in Western and Central Pennsylvania by market share, and it's the largest insurer in Western Pennsylvania. So, you know, it started as an academic medical center, and the innovation started long before me in 1973 when Dr. Detry got here, decided that Western Psychiatric Institute, which existed on federal grants, was, you know, needed to diversify its revenues, so it should become Western Psychiatric Institute and Clinic, and actually combine patient care with research. And you know, since that time, that was the beginning of UPMC. So, you know, as the investment banker in the 90s, most of the things that I did for UPMC were bond issues that affiliated with, you know, the academic core of UPMC, which was Presbyterian Hospital with a bunch of community hospitals, which generally people say is impossible to do and town and gown and it'll never work. But, you know, UPMC, to its credit, did these affiliations correctly. So, you know, now we have 42 hospitals from Western Pennsylvania through Central Pennsylvania, leaving out the international for a minute. And then, you know, because we were in Pittsburgh and because we had a payer that was 80% of our, that basically dictated the future of all the providers in Western Pennsylvania, the board of UPMC decided that, you know, becoming a payer wasn't something that would be nice to do. It was something that we had to do for the future of UPMC. So they committed to it in about 1996 and stuck with it through today. So that's how we became the largest payer, which, you know, everybody thinks is a good idea. And I can say is a really hard thing to do, become a payer that's, you know, comes out of a provider. There are a couple of the country that are pretty well known. We're on that list for the Western Pennsylvania part. And, you know, that's basically UPMC in a nutshell. It's gone from probably had $600 million in revenues when I first called on them to $21 billion today, about half payer, half provider. You know, the growth that we've had before the current events was, you know, Central Pennsylvania with the recent affiliations there. So we are not as big a payer in that market as we would love to be. But you know, that's a long-term investment and a long-term process. So that's it. You know, today we're 42 hospitals, about 40 hospitals domestically. You know, but people, other stuff people don't know about UPMC is, in addition to the hospitals we have in Ireland, we run a transplant center in Palermo, Italy since the late 90s. So we've done 1,200 transplants in Palermo, which was really a very innovative thing that happened when our current CEO and Dr. Detri said, we should just do them here instead of trying to ship all the patients from Palermo to London or to Pittsburgh or to other places in the States. So, you know, the thing that's called enterprise is just a name that we've used for the last 7 years that, you know, we use to describe the innovative stuff that has been happening at UPMC for almost 40 years now.
And how, on the payer front, I mean, as you know better than anybody, going all the way back to your banker days, you know, so many systems have been in and out of the payer operations where they thought it was a good idea, lost their shirt, frankly, and had to get out of it. And there's been even some recent examples of that over the last 3 or 4 years. How did you guys keep with that? And how did you stay with it? It just, you had better operators and better understanding of how to manage it, or more geographical reach, or?
I mean, I think, you know, we have, I mean, we know how to manage it. We know how to run it, but it wasn't really something that we chose to do. I mean, basically, you know, the Blues plan in Western Pennsylvania then was, it was still called Highmark, was, you know, controlled the payments that all providers got in Western Pennsylvania. So, I mean, Western Pennsylvania is a very different market than really any other one in the country. It is, when you look at the statistics, it is one of the most cost-effective places to get great quality healthcare. So we get great quality healthcare at really low prices. And that is because of the payer structure that existed, you know, since the steel industry and the unions in the 50s and 60s and 70s, that the rates here are, you know, extremely competitive, and you have to learn how to do more with less. And UPMC has been doing it for a long time. And that's why we chose to do more with less of our own money than, yeah, you know, relying on some other payer to do it. So a lot of, I mean, when you look at the other payers around the country, the other IDFS around the country, most of them, you know, have a reason that they had to do it. I mean, Kaiser basically started, I think, from, you know, Kaiser Steel in the, whatever, 1930s and 40s. You know, Geisinger is there, but, you know, Pennsylvania is a very unique market in that Highmark basically, you know, probably, you know, in 2012 when they bought West Penn Allegheny, decided that that was a strategy they were going to pursue too. And, you know, it's one that's resulted in great healthcare, great costs for the people of Western Pennsylvania.
Yeah. And I think that's a great point. I still feel like there's something that has to be there from the history and the mechanics in the market for you to be able to succeed in that. I mean, even Intermountain, that, you know, runs a significant, yep, amount of the health plan operations in Utah, as you know, everybody's got their sort of lineage. And then you see other systems try to replicate this strategy in markets that don't have the right sort of, not just demographics, but characteristics. And it just goes upside down, let alone maybe not the right people.
I mean, the payer business is cyclical. So it's going to go up and it's going to go down. I mean, when you talk about them losing their shirts, actually, most of the places that have tried to be a payer still have their shirts. You know, they just don't have the risk tolerance to say, oh my goodness, we lost $100 million in this business. You know, whatever will we do?
Right.
And, you know, if there's one differentiating factor about UPMC, it's the risk tolerance. It has the risk. It has a risk tolerance that doesn't exist in other, you know, quote unquote, nonprofits, be they healthcare systems or universities or whatever kind of nonprofit you want to say. And, you know, innovation is great, but without the willingness to take the risk, it's just a word. It doesn't really result in a, yep, financial difference. And, you know, UPMC innovation has resulted in a financial difference because, again, as you said, the best startup we ever did was the health plan, which has $12 billion in revenue today.
Right. Let's come back to that point about taking risks. And as we jump into, just for a sec, because we've been probing, as you can imagine, COVID for a while with a number of executives the last couple of months. What's it been like? You know, you and I were trying to get this on the books for a couple of months now, and obviously you guys have been very busy sort of dealing with this situation. What's it been like in the Pittsburgh market?
It hasn't been bad. I mean, yeah, you know, the challenge to COVID in the Pittsburgh market, and I think it's true in many, many markets, isn't really COVID, it's the response to COVID. You know, the challenge that you have when the governmental responses shut down an economy and, you know, basically shut down patients' willingness to come, or, you know, their ability to come. And, you know, as a provider, that's a really big problem because if the patients aren't coming, you know, you're not getting paid. Now, you know, when they're payers and providers, when you are a payer provider, you're getting the dollar up front. you don't have to look much further than Kaiser's results to see how much better it is to be on the payer provider side during something like this than it is to just be a provider.
And do you think that's, I mean, because of the Pittsburgh market and what you maybe had a smaller outbreak or a continual smaller outbreak compared to other areas of the country, like New York, even Boston here, do you think that's changed people's mindsets at all there? Or is it, I mean, you guys have such a broad reach too. It's not just Western Pennsylvania. Do you think the administrators and yourself are thinking differently, or you always had that mindset to your point about, hey, we're willing to take more risk quicker than most?
I think our mindset of taking more risk is different than other providers.
Yeah.
Payers are a little more, you know, from my standpoint, because they're, many of them are for-profits and they're huge. They're able to take a lot more risk than, you know, even the biggest set of providers. But you know, I think it's going to change everybody's view towards how healthcare gets delivered. And you know, the federal government has done what they've done with, you know, the money that they've dispersed to the health systems. And you know, from where I sit, sitting here today, you know, our volumes are kind of back.
Yeah.
They are back. So, you know, whatever the federal government has done with the grants and the advances has kept the health system, you know, in a position to be able to quote unquote deal with this issue, the pandemic and you know, the hotspots. Okay. But I mean, I don't think anybody's telling you, you know, that we know exactly what's going to happen in the next 3 months.
Right.
I mean, what we see today is flu season coming, and generally speaking, our hospitals fill up during flu season, and you know, the ability to differentiate between COVID-19 and the flu, not sure we have yet. So it's going to continue to be a challenge for providers all over the country, including for us, even in the in most of the country where the outbreak hasn't filled. I mean, our ICU beds, I think 15% of them were full at the peak, so we weren't. Right. And the places that I read about in you know, Houston now or wherever, Florida, we're hovering around 85% worried about what happens next. So,
and do you think, maybe taking it out of the UPMC context, but put it into a peer context, do you think there'll be systematic change in thinking and timing and risk tolerance, maybe more closer to your experience at UPMC at other systems around the country because of this?
I think it's hard to drive the change as any particular system. You know, frankly, the government is the entity that has to decide whether there's going to be a change or not going to be a change. So you know, at least from my personal opinion is that what happens in the election is going to determine more of what the healthcare system looks like in this country than anything that any innovation center, even a world-class one like UPMC Enterprises, can pull off in the next 3 to 6 months. So
yeah. And then maybe just one more on the payer side of it. Do you think there's a flip side or a long tail? We've got a couple of partners, a very large national payer, and we've also got a very large regional payer we've had some discussions with, that it's almost the inverse in time in terms of the challenges. And so the health systems see it at first, then the lag on screening, the lag on chronic complex management because of this. Does the payer sort of take it in the shorts, if you will, later on as this kind of tail of management happens?
You know, if you told me that COVID was going to be over tomorrow and everybody could go get the care they wanted without thinking about it, then probably the payers would wind up paying all the money out that they've been not paying out.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't see it being that quick a solution. So I think, you know, I think that the pressure there, you know, is more going to come from, you know, the governments who are saying, why does this payer have all this money sitting over here when the provider system in this state is suffering? And so I think that's more the governmental risk than it is. Yeah, the ability of the payers to take it in the shorts. I'm not quite sure. I mean, our payment system in this country doesn't really work very well. During a global pandemic where you shut down the economy and people don't go for the, you know, the wrong people have the money.
And how about your view on VBC? Do you think this accelerates it? I mean, I happen to agree with your point about the election. I think the answer to this question also ties into that, which is, you know, we've been on sort of a standstill, in my opinion, on VBC since the Trump administration's come into office compared to what we saw with Obama and everything else going all the way back to Berwick at CMS. Do you feel like that could potentially shift here with all what's going on and then even potentially administration change?
Yeah, I think the shifts, you know, whatever happens, you know, the shifts are going to wind up being driven by, you know, the biggest payer, which is the government.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that, you know, if there's ever a reason to have significant changes in how the system works, we would think this would drive it. But, you know, sitting here in this environment today with this political environment, I'm not sure anybody's going to make a prediction of where it's going to wind up going. I think it's got to go, you know, literally sort of month to month and
yeah,
see what winds up happening. But, you know, UPMC, you know, we are continuing to focus on taking care of the patients. We're pleased with the care that we're able to give to the people who were able to come to us for the last 6 months. We're pleased we're back and providing the care, be it digital or in person, to people who are here now. And even with the COVID patients, someday somebody will do a study about what the outcomes look like and everything else. But I think we are doing a good job for the patients that we're caring for.
And maybe one last question before we flip over to sort of innovation, enterprise, et cetera. When you start thinking about, the size of UPMC's balance sheet and some of the other larger systems that are out there, do you think that we could see a lot more, not just consolidation, but being more opportunistic coming out of this environment and in this environment of even building much broader national footprints than we've already seen?
Yeah, I think it's hard. I don't know. Everybody wonders why. There are a couple of for-profits that have done some roll-ups of providers, but you have so many quality providers providing quality healthcare to their specific regions. And in our case, and in many cases, they're tied to an academic medical center, to a university. So it's really, when you start thinking of it in terms of a corporate finance, I'm going to roll up 20 academic medical centers. That's just not going to happen. People have tried to sort of run an academic medical center as a for-profit, but it's not consistent with the mission. Our margins aren't what they could be because we reinvest several hundred million dollars a year back into the academic mission of Pitt. That's why we exist. And so, to do that and then to say, make up whatever city you want that has an academic medical center. Oh, we're going to become affiliated with that academic medical center, and we're going to figure out how to reinvest these dollars in Pittsburgh and the other dollars in wherever. It's a complicated equation that is hard to replicate.
But how about something as narrow as creating national provider networks of specialty lines? So we've heard that from a couple of different players lately that says, hey, look, if we're going to have telehealth grow across the base, then what's the supplemental clinical resources that are academically the experts? Do you feel like that might be a trend that might come out of this as well?
At this point, right, since Dr. Google doesn't exist yet, you still need the physicians. And so I think, to roll up, there are obviously specialties that you can roll up, but that it makes sense to roll up. The question becomes with those specialties, how they get offered to the people who are purchasing them. So in our case, if you're an employer, Western Pennsylvania, it's really hard as an employer to offer a health plan to your employees that doesn't include UPMC. So it doesn't, if somebody does roll up, transplant, right? Nobody in Pittsburgh is going to go to Joe's Transplant Hospital when they could go to UPMC. And without that, even though most of the subscribers to a health plan don't use those kinds of services, you buy insurance, particularly if you're an employer, you offer insurance to your employees and you don't want to explain to them why you're not offering that academic medical center, despite the fact that the employer's paying the bill anyway. So until my personal thought is that the most radical change you can make to the healthcare system would be to take the employer out of the purchasing decision. And then you might have a better chance of rolling up providers on a cost basis, because then consumers would be able to select, I don't have to go to UPMC, but I think we're a long way from that kind of radical change.
That makes sense. Why don't we flip over to the innovation side? I was reading an article where you were quoted, I think over the last month or two, in Becker's about innovation isn't optional, as a quote I think you had.
Yeah, I think I did say that. I was kind of
that off. It was quoted well. I was like, wow, was that Tal? That was a
How did he come
statement.
Up with that? Yeah,
but tie that into sort of, again, I've been a little bit in awe of what you guys have done, because you guys were well ahead of all this with the enterprises group and the fund structure. So this feels a bit more, at least just listening to you, it's a more, regardless of COVID, you feel like you guys have already been in this flow about what you have to do. But when you think about innovation and you've got this one side of you that's got this kind of banker treasury function, and then the other side of you has got the enterprises and the innovation function, how do you manage that day to day, and how do you think about that day to day?
The one thing to remember, Keith, is that we're not a fund. So the treasurer has, between the health planner, between all the money that we probably have, today we have $9 billion on the balance sheet because we borrowed a bunch, but we have $7 billion. So all of that is supposed to be invested in the future of UPMC. So enterprises is about, enterprise is what we call the investments we make in the future of UPMC. And so when you look at how much we deploy every year, so say it's $300 million, most people are like, oh my God, they deploy $300 million on all these risky venture capital investments. And that's like true if that's how you look at it. But the other thing that's true is that if you don't wind up changing yourself, you're going to get changed. And so, you know, that's where innovation is not optional, is really meaningful, because like the provider business is one that you has to change. You know, I don't think anybody would argue that the margins in the provider, on the provider side of the business, given that particularly in Pittsburgh, the government's our biggest payer, and you know, the inflation rates don't meet what our employees get paid. So we have to figure out a way to do more for less. So that's really where innovation came from. And if you're not reinventing, you know, if you're sitting there with that money on your balance sheet and saying, you know, I have this money on my balance sheet, I need to preserve my AA credit rating, you're not going to have a AA credit rating.
So would you suggest to most folks around most healthcare systems around the country, because there's been some interesting debate over the last year or so about should health systems really be, which I always laugh at because all day long, especially on the academic side, you're innovating every day. But should you really be deploying capital in this way? Because people are, to your point, it's not a fund. It's just an allocation of your capital about reinventing yourself constantly, I think is a better reframing of the discussion of, well, why does a healthcare system have a fund?
Why do they have a corporate venture operation? I mean, yeah. Because they have to.
You know, right.
Every organization like can't afford to just sit there and not reinvest in itself. So, you know, whether you call it a corporate venture thing, whether you call it a fund, whether you call it enterprises, whatever you call it, like these investments are about making sure the organization is successful in its mission. You know, they aren't about necessarily a financial return.
Yeah.
They have to have a financial return over time, but I don't need to, you know, we don't have a fund partially because, you know, I don't want to look back in 3 years and say, oh, our IRR was only 18%. No, we invested in Joe's venture capital fund, it would have been 22. So we screwed up. I mean, it's probably not true.
Right. Totally. And do you view, I mean, because you've been in this too, with the allocation of some of that capital into a lot of digital health investments on the first phase of this, and now some of that allocation is going into the new bio and device side of it. Do you think we're past this tipping point with digital health now? And does COVID sort of mark that? And does the Livongo deal and Teladoc mark that? I'm just curious your thoughts because you've been at it for so long.
I'm sure that we are 100 times more likely to do a telehealth visit for any particular patient today than we were in January. When you talk about the tipping point for digital health, you know, what you're really talking about is taking much of the infrastructure that exists in the provider system and getting rid of it. You know, that's really the tipping point isn't, you know, putting the cameras on all the physicians' desks. It's actually, you know, getting rid of the front desks that they have, so they actually don't need the desk. They can do the visit like you're doing in your house, right? And so I think that tipping point isn't going to happen in 2020. It isn't going to happen in 2021. I think it's going to happen. You know, I think we're still, before COVID, we might have been 20 years from it. You know, maybe COVID will make it 5 or 6. But that's dependent on, you know, that pressure continuing to do things virtually as opposed to doing things in person. So.
And how about your view about the Livongo Teladoc deal in terms of, you know, is that an outlier in all this? Is that a, you know, is that really a flag, one mark in the 5 or 6 year trench on this? I mean, how?
Yeah, I mean, from my standpoint, like, I don't know. I try to actually not use the word deal, because anytime you use the word deal, it's like, that's a great deal. But it depends. The deal, you know, that got announced is closing in the fourth quarter, whatever the hell it is, it has nothing to do with what actually happens the day after they close the deal. So, I mean, Teladoc Livongo might be it, but I can't tell you today because they paid whatever they paid for whatever they got. You know, it depends on what happens 3 years from now.
I wanted you to put your banker hat on and kind of explain to me the multiple. That was the big question.
Honestly, like, you know, I have not paid that much attention to the Teladoc Livongo deal.
So. Interesting. You guys have made some headway and some noise over the last year about shifting more of the allocation of capital into sort of life sciences, device diagnostics. What was behind that?
It's really about the academic medical center, and it's about the researchers we have at the University of Pittsburgh. So when you look at immunotherapy as a industry, if you want to call it that, you know, all that came out of some academic medical center. And if you want to look at the Livongo Teladoc multiples, you know, they pale in comparison to Juno and Kite. And that knowledge resides at Pitt. And, you know, our theory
is that instead of having some awful venture capital fund make all that money, that we actually think keeping some of it for the University of Pittsburgh and for UPMC is a pretty good idea. So we have, you know, intentionally worked with our researchers over the next, over the last 4 or 5 years, really, you know, to make sure that they feel like they have the same kind of an opportunity staying at UPMC and staying at Pitt and maintaining their academic mission and their research, but you know, they don't have to leave to go to, you know, a startup company, because we have created that kind of an infrastructure for them to benefit just like they would if they went to Joe's venture capital fund. So that's really the reason that we have, you know, already spent probably $250 million, you know, committed another $750 million to that particular space. Because if you want to talk about disruption, immunotherapy is something that I'm not an expert in, but if I understand it correctly, it will take cancer treatment and make all the things that we're doing today completely irrelevant. Yeah. And take the hospitals that we have full of cancer patients and empty them out, and there'll be hotels that, you know, people are on immunotherapy for, and 20% of the people that are on the immunotherapy will have to come back into a really intensive care unit, and the rest of them are going to be in a hotel for 2 weeks and then be fine and go home. And so if you look down the road 20 years from now, that's the kind of space that we need to figure out how we're going to change. And it's better to be part of the change than to watch the change happen to you. So that's why we're investing that part of it. That's not, I would say, like, we didn't say, oh, we have this amount of dollars for UPMC Enterprises, so we're going to take some from digital and apply it to translational sciences, which is what we call that space. We actually said we're going to take what we're spending in digital and add to it and invest more in translational sciences. So
That was where I was going to go with it, which is it still seems like there's a focus still on digital. So there'll be a translational push and a digital push sort of simultaneously between the groups.
Yep. I mean, yeah, the simplest way to describe it, the simplest way I describe it is if you look at the threats to an academic medical center, like UPMC, there's one threat that's called big tech, which is, oh my goodness, Amazon's going to, and Microsoft and Google and Apple are going to disrupt us. So our investments in digital solutions are designed to stave that off and make sure we are still playing in that particular game. The translational sciences one is the same thing for pharma. So, I mean, if you look at what immunotherapy is, pharma company is going to replace our Hillman Cancer Center with a bunch of drugs, and we don't want that to happen. So,
yep. And I mean, you maybe pressing on that a little bit on the sort of retail and big tech, when you think about what Walmart is doing, you know, back to the threat side of the equation, I mean, should that really be viewed as a demonstrable threat where it's walking into very, you know, mostly rural because of where their footprint is and being very transparent, low price point, and delivering, in theory, pretty good care? Should most healthcare systems around the country really be worried about that threat in the next 5 years?
Yeah, you have to worry about that as a threat. But I mean, you know, depending on the kind of healthcare system you are, right? And, you know, if you have a primary care office that's sitting next to a Walmart, it's definitely a threat that the person finds it more convenient to walk into the Walmart than to try to call your primary care office and get in there. You know, as an academic medical center and the kinds of services that, you know, much of our revenue comes from a much, much higher acuity of care. So you're not going to, I don't think anybody's going to go to Walmart for a transplant anytime soon. So it's definitely a threat to a part of our business, but you know, there are threats to, you know, each and every piece of our business from those places, whether it's Walmart, whether it's CVS, whether it's Teladoc or Mongo. So yeah, it's definitely on our radar screen as something to be concerned about, whether that's sustainable, or whether they're willing to invest in that and have people come into Walmart for healthcare. You know, I'm not sure that if Walmart were a new startup and they decided, hey, we're just going to start these clinics around the country, I'm not sure that would work. But you know, if they could leverage it into the rest of their business, that's great.
And maybe getting to some of the close on our discussion, which is, you know, what, when you step back, and again, you've been at this for a long time, you know, what are the sort of top three areas that you're most excited about right now? I mean, I think we've talked about some, but just maybe more pointed in terms of where you and the team get really excited right now and thinking about pointing some capital.
I mean, on a personal level, I'm excited to get, like, you know, actually meet with people in person again instead of doing these video calls.
This has been so much fun. Come on.
But that probably doesn't count, right?
Yeah. I don't think we'll be seeing each other over a drink at JP Morgan this year, I hate to say.
Oh, man. Darn it. Ruined my vision again. Have they canceled it yet?
No, not that I know of.
Virtual JP Morgan. Think about that as a Zoom meeting, too.
Oh, but, horrible.
You know, I mean, UPMC is we're excited every day about the stuff that we're already doing. So, I mean, one, we have 90,000 people and most of them are caring for our patients. And so that's something that each and every one of them wakes up every day and is excited about. We're really excited about our ability to do it at a time when, it's been really, really hard. So, at least so far, I think it's August, right? Middle of August, we feel like we're getting on top of our ability to do that. But, it's exciting to work at UPMC. So whether it's translational sciences, whether it's the health plan, whether it's international, whether it's digital, that's an exciting. We're excited about all of the different things that we're doing, whether it's what we've done for 40 years or whether it's what we're going to do for the next 40 years. So I'm not sure I could pick out the top three.
Yeah. Well, great. This is, Tal, this has been wonderful. And I appreciate you taking the time. I know you're busy and I don't want to, I see the golf statue behind you. So I don't want to, you got to kind of still have some golf somewhere in that repertoire.
Oh, I haven't played since yesterday. So don't feel too bad for me.
I really appreciate your time and your discussions and more importantly, your friendship over the years.
Great to be with you too, virtually.
That's right, virtually. Take care, man.
See you.
All right, well, that is a wrap. Thanks, everyone, for joining us on this episode of Healthcare is Hard, a podcast for insiders. You can find Keith on LinkedIn. You can find him on Twitter. He is at Keith Figlioli. That is spelled Figlioli. I'm on there as well. I'm Tom Salemi. I'm editorial director of the Device Talks Conferences and host of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. You can find that on all podcast channels, and I'm on Twitter at MedTechTom. That's it, folks. Tune in next time. We'll have another great episode of Healthcare is Hard, a podcast for insiders.